Okay, so it's September 6th, 2017. I'm Rick Hansen. And lately, as you probably know, we've been exploring relationships as a support for practice and a field of practice. And most recently, have been exploring forgiveness, including very, very recently, self-forgiveness, including last week, a focus on self-acceptance. And I wanted to sort of step back a bit and widen out the consideration, because from time to time I've been framing these topics in a Buddhist context, and I wanted to sort of step back with you and open it up to an exploration of what is Buddhism altogether? What's the framework in which we're talking here about relating to others and oneself from a standpoint of non-harming and mindfulness and loving kindness? Like, why and what's that about? So I just kind of want to go back to the fundamentals, go back to the basics. I worked for a mathematician for a year when I was in my late 20s doing probabilistic risk analyses. I was the guy in the bowels of things, you know, coding Fortran and sticking punch cards into the machine. This is like the late 1970s, back in the dark ages. And anyway, but he's a great guy. I learned so much from him. And he said at one point, Rick, a real mathematician is someone who wakes up in the morning and asks, what is a number, actually? I always liked that. Back to the fundamentals, you know? You get, like, the questions kids ask, you know? Why is this guy up? Like, why don't we float away? You know, well, they really get at the core questions. Or why are people mean to each other? Right? Very fundamental question. So I want to kind of go back to the roots here. And I'll do it in the framework of the Four Noble Truths as an organizing framework. So to begin with, we start in the Four Noble Truths, as the Buddha did, with a recognition of and exploration of suffering, broadly defined. And the word for suffering in the language of early Buddhism, the word is dukkha, whose roots are very useful to understand as the meeting in this culture 2,500 years ago, very agrarian, pre-literate, pre-industrial, obviously, the meeting of an axle and a wheel in a cart. That's dukkha. And the meeting that is not quite right, kind of a wonky, wobbly grinding. It's such a lovely metaphor for suffering. The term suffering encompasses both pain and what could be called suffering, physical pain, what the Buddha called the first art of life, including emotional pain at the sorrows of others or loss of those we love. But his primary focus was on what he called the second dart of suffering, the darts we add ourselves, our reaction to the bare immediacy of pleasure and pain. As he lived and taught, as best we gather, for about 45 years after his own awakening, he still experienced physical pain. He experienced physical pain toward the end of his life when he most likely died, late 70s, early 80s, of food poisoning. And he also described emotional pain at losing people that he had known for many years who were close to him. So there was still the fundamental kind of immediacy as an animal with a body that's deeply, deeply social and emotional. There's sort of an inherent pain, but suffering is what we add to it. There's, you may have heard the saying, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. That kind of distinction there. So we start with that. And in modern language, we would include a sense of pressure, or stress, irritation, anxiety, frustration, exasperation, hurt, feelings of inadequacy, various aspects of anger. They would all be in the territory, ruminating about things, rehashing, going over things. And if you start to look closely with mindfulness, there are a lot of subtleties of suffering. In some ways, I think growth proceeds in four stages, described, I think, by Peter Drucker originally as unconscious incompetence, conscious incompetence, conscious competence, and unconscious competence. And the second stage is the hardest, where you become aware of things, but they don't change yet. So sometimes we become more aware through mindfulness as we come into the body, We track our emotions. We increase in what I call a granularity of mindfulness. We start seeing little things with other people and ourselves. Sometimes we become more aware of the suffering. It's not that the suffering has grown. We've grown in our capacity to be mindful of it. This is a necessary, albeit uncomfortable and challenging stage. So that's the first noble truth. It's not that life is entirely suffering. It's that simply there is a fair amount of suffering in this life that is constructed. It's not inherent. In some fundamental sense, it's needless. It comes from our relationship to circumstances and experiences, and it's not inherent, this kind of suffering, in circumstances and experiences themselves. Right there, that idea is a breakthrough idea for many people. Wow, my irritation, my upset, my distress is not inherent in, you know, the red light here, or being unable to find a parking space. It's not inherent in the words you just used to me. It's not inherent in that. It's something added to that. That's a remarkable freeing insight just right there. It also takes us to responsibility, because it brings it right home that we, ourselves, inheriting our own very ancient nervous system, we ourselves are constructing our own suffering. It's very poignant. Then the second noble truth is an exploration of the causes of this add-on suffering. Why? Why would we do that? Why would Mother Nature plan that out for us? What? Why is the sky up? What is a number, actually? Why is there suffering? And the Buddha's drive theory of suffering is that the root of so much suffering, perhaps the deep root of all the added suffering, is, in a word, craving. That's an English translation of a word in Pali, the language of early Buddhism, that's tanha, whose roots are thirst. Something is missing, something is wrong. Large or small, often quite small. Still, there's a subtlety of alarm when things are unpleasant. Something's missing, something's wrong. There can be subtleties of drivenness, chasing, grasping, holding on when things are pleasant. Always looking for something new to want, with a subtle sense of dis-ease, unease in the background. Something missing, something wrong. That's the root, neuropsychologically, biologically, of craving. It's a deficit or disturbance state. It's a response, rather, to a sense of deficit or disturbance. And then also you have these subtleties interpersonally. What did you mean by that? Do you still like me? What's up? Do you like them more? Or just the history, hurt, insecure attachment, feelings of inadequacy. I was walking across the hall and I was thinking of someone I know well, and I winced slightly at a certain subtle tension that remains in our relationship. So the Buddhist theory, it's a hypothesis, is that these states of craving, disturbance, deficit, something missing, drivenness, are a primary, perhaps the primary root of our suffering. And then in the third noble truth, he says it's actually possible to step out of that movie. It's actually possible to stop relating to our circumstances and our experiences from a standpoint of something missing, something wrong. We can relate to them differently. And in fact, we can progressively relate to them differently, and ultimately, he declares the possibility of an irrevocable transformation, a permanent change of relationship. Not going on retreat and getting happier and wiser and more peaceful, and coming back, you know, still having gotten something from it, but coming back down to earth again. He's talking about a fundamental kind of awakening. So that's the larger frame, first, second, and third noble truths, with a path that has eight major elements, that's laid out progressively as a progressive process that in some ways ultimately brings us all the way back home again, uncovering our underlying true nature, our natural state that's been underneath it all. But as T.S. Eliot put it, at the end of our journeying or explorations, we come back to where we started, but we know the place truly now for the first time. That's a paraphrase. So that's the larger frame. And I wanted to read you a few passages and then open it up for discussion, questions, things like that. Okay, so far? And it really helps to keep bringing it back to, we're talking about our own experience. That's one thing that I find really useful and powerful and refreshing about Buddhism. It's not about metaphysical realities or cosmology. It's about our actual psychology and experience that we can recognize very, very directly and come home to it. So it helps to bring it home. You know, where are you at with subtleties of contraction, pressure, chasing, rather than feeling like there's a fullness, come on in, an enoughness, a contentment, a peacefulness already. So the first passage I'd like to read is from a wonderful teacher and scholar named Andrew Alensky. He was the executive director of the Insight Meditation Society for a while on the in the East Coast in Massachusetts, sort of Spirit Rock's kind of sister center, family relationship there. Then he peeled off as a scholar himself. He has a PhD in, I think, religious studies at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, one of my favorite places. And he's now an independent writer and so forth. So this is his writing I want to share with you, including a quotation from early Buddhism. So I'm going to talk a bit here about the psychology of practice and awakening. So Andy, I know him as a friend, he writes here, "As the Buddha walked from town to village along the Ganges Valley after his awakening, people would come to him wanting to know what had happened to him under that tree," where the Bodhi tree, he had his awakening. "What happened? How do I get some of what you got?" Right? Natural question. And they wanted to know whether they too might be able to accomplish the same feat. The Buddha talked about it in terms of a radical psychological transformation. Andy is a deep scholar of Buddhism, so this is a deep scholar talking here. You might disagree with it, others might disagree with it, but he really has chops in this area. As a psychological transformation. "Before the moment of awakening, he constructed suffering in the same way the rest of us do, forged in the fires of craving. But in the moment afterwards of his awakening, his mind and body were dramatically purified of all unwholesome or unskilled states. All the emotions rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion were cut off, uprooted, annihilated, dried up, extinguished, withdrawn, and otherwise abandoned once and for all." Andy is pointing to words that show up again and again in the Buddha's account of what happened to him. "And this change was such that it was no longer possible for these afflictive emotions to manifest themselves in the Buddha's experience. The Buddha spoke of it as finding peace, becoming cool, reaching safety, putting down the burden, attaining liberation. And he used a wide range of similar imagery to express the final irreversible cessation of suffering." That's the word for the third noble truth, nirodha, cessation. "He continued to live for the duration of his natural life as any other person might, eating, sleeping, talking, and meditating, though as one who experiences an unshakable sense of well-being in the face of any and all conditions." For me, that's such a wonderful summary of why I practice and why I suspect many of us practice as well. It's aspirational. It's out there. We're going in that direction. But it really gets at what our heart is longing for, what our heart intuits is indeed natural and possible to us, is to relate to circumstances and experiences in this way. And then there's a further description of in this way when it's fully realized. And then we keep moving in that direction. They say in Tibet, Gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation in an upward spiral. So, at the ultimate, the Buddha's own description of his state, in response to someone who says to him, who stumbled upon him, actually bumped into him in a forest gathering early in the morning, is the larger context here, who said, I hope you are well, noble sir. That's the start of this little passage. And the Buddha replies, at least as has come down to us, indeed, the sage who is fully quenched, quenched is a metaphor for nirvana, cooled, pulled off the heat. Indeed, the sage who is fully quenched rests at ease in every way. No sense desire adheres to this person whose fires have cooled, deprived of fuel. All attachments have been severed. The heart's been led away from pain. Tranquil, the sage rests with utmost ease. The mind has found its way to peace. Buddha's description of his own state of being. And personally, I don't think people would have stuck around and sought him out for the next 40-some-odd years if that wasn't actually his condition, especially in the context of northern India at the time, where people were serious about spiritual practice, and there was a lot of deep practice there. Okay? So I just want to offer two more little quotations to you and then sort of open it up to questions about Buddhism or anything we've talked about so far. And my encouragement to you, by the way, when we get to the questions and discussion, is focus on questions that are experientially gripping for you personally, distinct from very appropriate, interesting questions that are more theoretical or philosophical or, you know, kind of what about. As much as you can, I really recommend you look deeply into your own heart these days. What's your growing edge? What would be useful for you to clarify? Okay. So, two more brief quotes. One is from the Dharma, as it's been handed down to us, the discourses, the suttas. Silent in body, silent in speech, silent in mind. Without defilement, blessed with silence is the sage. One is truly washed of evil. Quick note, those terms are probably older translations, evil and defilement. There are other words that tend to be used more as defilement being kind of like internal poisons, internal afflictions, internal things that are, we could say, impurities that weigh us down. It's not, the frame here is pragmatic, not moralistic. And the mind, one is truly washed of evil. It really means one is washed of any inclination toward harm of oneself or anyone else. That's really the frame here. But so to go back then, silent in body, silent in speech, silent in mind, without any afflictions, blessed with silence is the sage. One is truly washed clean. Wow. You see silence there is used. The Buddha used language well. I'm sure he had internal speech. His brain was not damaged after his awakening. But you can get a sense of what they're talking about there. No noise. No disturbance. Just clean, just straight, just pure. Again, aspirational. This is the statement of full realization, but a movement in that direction, a drawing in that direction. And then, to really mess with things, so far, I've spoken, and Andy has spoken, Andy Alensky, entirely psychologically inside a very natural, ordinary framework. Nothing supernatural so far, nothing transcendental. There's a whole layer of Buddhism that relates more to that, those aspects that are sort of trans-psychological, they're trans-natural causes. They refer to supernatural phenomena such as reincarnation, a larger framework, and also ultimately to transcendental matters, usually referred to in Buddhism kind of obscurely and ambiguously and mysteriously as the unconditioned, the deathless. All right. I haven't gone there yet, but I just want to acknowledge that there is that aspect of deep practice. Some people relate to it very much, some people relate to it not at all. Many people are kind of in the middle with a wait and see, you know, attitude along the way. Okay. This is from Thomas Merton, who was a Christian monastic, as well as a Zen practitioner with a deep interest in Buddhism. Quite a remarkable person from what I've gleaned. And in terms of the word silence, he offers a take here that opens us out into some deeper waters. Here we go. He writes in this poem, "Be still. Listen to the stones of the wall. Be silent. They try to speak your name. Listen to the living walls. Who are you? Who are you? Whose silence are you?" That's it. Want me to read that again?
Yeah.
Yeah, really? "Be still. Listen to the stones of the wall. Be silent. They try to speak your name. Listen to the living walls. Who are you? Who are you? Whose silence are you?" I'm going to send an announcement out about something I should have said, that this, we will not be meeting here in 2 weeks because the university is having an event, but I will include this quotation in the notice I send out. If you like. Okay, so that's what I've explored so far with you. Kind of want to open it up to reboot. What is a number actually? What is Buddhism actually? What is suffering actually? What is craving actually? What am I doing here actually? Whose silence am I actually? Okay. So questions or comments? Please.
I want to thank you for your foundations course, first of all. It's been extremely helpful to me.
Thank you.
My question is about safety, satisfaction, and connection.
All right.
And how that might relate to craving.
Oh, yeah.
And if we use the positive neuroplasticity to address our specific needs, is it similar or the same as addressing craving and cessation?
Well, my eyes just light up because you are talking about something that I've been extremely interested in for a number of years now. And it could be that I'll say a couple things here you already understand, in the context of your question. Very briefly, the question is, well, why do we crave? And the answer to that question a lot in the early texts is pretty minimal. It's said, well, because you're a self. Well, what does it mean to be a self, and why is craving inherent in selfing? What does that actually mean? So from the perspective of psychology and neuropsychology, it's bodies that crave. Why do bodies crave? Why do dogs crave? Why do squirrels crave? Are we the only species on the planet that craves? What does that actually mean? So in the framework of psychology and biology, craving is a drive state in relationship to a need. Something is missing, something is wrong in relationship to what we need. See? So it's grounded in needs. And for me, it's actually been revelatory to explore craving in the framework of evolutionary neuropsychology because it has huge practical implications. Briefly, a common framework of needs is three needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection, managed by avoiding pain, approaching pleasure, and attaching to others. Or I could say more generally, avoiding harms, approaching rewards, attaching to others. That's kind of an overarching framework. So if need striving, craving in that sense, is based on a sense of not enoughness, not all rightness, imbalance. That's the basic idea. What would solve that problem? Well, a long way to solving that problem is to meet the next moment, or to allow the next moment to arrive, feeling already full, already balanced in terms of your needs. You see that? Bingo. Bingo. How to do that? The how very much, I think, logically and based on studies that suggest that this is plausible, and certainly my own experience, if we repeatedly register through positive neuroplasticity, if we repeatedly internalize authentic experiences of needs met, usually mild, usually brief experiences in the flow of everyday life, sometimes more intense, as if we repeatedly register them, we learn to feel that our needs are met. We grow, we learn. We actually literally, over time, internalize a growing sense of safety in its various aspects. And we also internalize psychological resources of various kinds that give us a sense of capability when we meet needs. Needs will be challenged. Challenges will keep coming. But do we face those challenges with a sense of alarm and not enoughness and sketchiness and positionality and so forth? Or do we meet them with a sense of equanimity and confidence with an open heart so that we're not put on tilt or pushed, as I call it, into the red zone? So just think about that takeaway, repeatedly internalizing authentic experiences related to safety or resources that help you be safe and feel safe. Then increasingly you can meet the next moment, including threats to safety, with a deep core of inner peace as an umbrella term for what it feels like when you feel completely safe. You go to peace. And the same thing could be said with our needs for satisfaction, broadly defined. If we meet the next moment with a sense of gratitude already, gladness already, successfulness already, fullness already, we approach the next moment with a sense of contentment, even if we grapple with frustration, disappointment, and loss. And same for our needs for a relationship. If we internalize again and again experiences of connection already, receiving caring and giving caring, then when we meet the next moment, we do so with confidence and love rather than hurt or resentment or hatred. In my view, the practice I describe takes care of the deep biological roots of craving progressively. I can watch this in myself. I can also see that having done this for quite a while, there's still grit in there, there's still dust, cobwebs, old habits, takes a while. I think on top of this practice, there are other really important practices to do. And even when you feel already full, there's a certain tendency handed to us with good intentions by Mother Nature toward auto-craving, delusional craving, where you feel perfectly safe and you're still scanning for threats. You feel amazingly full and you're still thinking about what the next dessert might be or what else you could want, right? You feel perfectly rested in, you feel liked enough and loved enough, but you'd like approval from one more person still, or something, right? So there's that, and then there's some subtleties that are inherent in cognizing just moment to moment, where there's an inherent kind of stretching for or reaching for the next moment of experience that I think is inherent in cognizing and has a subtle tension in it. You can observe it if your mind is still very quiet. I think that's kind of the last to fall away when you go into cessation. So in any case, that's a very deep practice. And to me, it's perfectly authentic. It rings really true, and it's a beautiful path along the way. They say in Tibet, you take the fruit as the path. If the fruit of a good life is, in plain English, feeling happy, loving, and peaceful, sounds pretty good to me, right? You're happy already, you're loving already, and you're at peace. That's the fruit of a good life. This practice takes the fruit as the path, and values and registers and wants to marinate in, experiences a fullness already along the way.
Right there.
Click. Very good. And of course, it has to be authentic. And what you start to notice, by the way, with this, is that the mind is complex. It's a huge network, several hundred trillion synapses, all kinds of little systems operating, dozens, maybe even hundreds of little subpersonalities and voices inside and drives in various kinds. You can feel very settled and equanimous here with a certain amount of chatter yipping around the edges. The fundamental question is, does it invade your mind and remain? That was the Buddha's description. Does it invade the core of your being and hijack you? And that's the key distinction. Okay. Other questions or comments, including about Buddhism? Okay, great. So, yeah, please. I'll kind of sweep this way. Yeah.
Okay. What's the difference between what you just described and complacency?
It's a great question.
What was the question?
What's the difference between what I just described and complacency? Or apathy versions of that, or even another version is sort of like selfish hedonism. Mm-hmm. It's great. What's interesting is that, with rare exceptions that I will not identify by name, most people, when they truly have a lot in their life, they kind of settle down. You know, but the key is to, most people when they experience being fully, truly safe or truly satisfied or truly connected, their body and brain, and it's natural. You see it in other animals. We share our genetics and our nervous system very much with other animals, especially mammals and primates. So when zebras or mice or monkeys are fully fed, I had a teacher who wrote the book titled about food, "The Eating Gorilla Comes in Peace." When we truly experience needs met, people tend to not be complacent or self-satisfied or selfish. They actually tend to become generous and more patient, more easygoing, and they want to help good things happen. Generally, not everyone, generally. And so for me, it's typically because people are experiencing pleasures, but they're not internalizing them. They live in gated communities. They drive cars that are amazingly safe. The crime rate where they live is amazingly low. And they're still looking for enemies out there to send out of the country. Right? And you can see that interpersonally as well. And you can see the same thing, yeah, interpersonally. So for me, that's the takeaway for me is, are you really registering? Are you really marinating in? Are you really internalizing these wholesome experiences I'm describing? And then see what happens when you do. Usually, the body is designed to just default to a basically good place. Second, there's always the important aspect of morality. There's no replacement, as the Buddha taught, and others have too, for values, for morality. So even as the psychological process can proceed, one can still hopefully have morals, ethics, standards, aims, ideals that would move a person away from, let's say, complacency. There's the hell realm in so-called in Tibet, beings with godlike powers. They're called hungry ghosts. They have enormous appetites, craving, but their capacity to satisfy their appetites is represented as a pinhole for a mouth. And I think of that as Western consumer culture in a lot of ways. And a lot of unhappy people in Beverly Hills. A lot of unhappy people with lots of power in Washington, D.C. and the other capitals of the world. How can we actually register our experiences? One reason why I think it's often said the poorest people in the world generally are the happiest, above a certain level of misery. And this isn't to justify poverty. It's just to point out that the most important thing is, do we internalize these beneficial experiences and then take them with us wherever we go? Okay, next person was over here. No? Okay.
Well,
any more? No?
It's just a merchant-esque question. Who craves?
It's a good question.
This gets into the question of the conceptual self and the real person. And we can't cover all that. But do you imagine generally that we're all walking around with two entities in present with us? One is that conceptual false self doesn't really exist, and the others are actual person, are our historic being that walks and experiences, so on and so forth. Are there always those two people?
What's the second kind?
Are there always those two?
What is the second kind?
The real historic person that happened to have your name tag in front. But there is somebody there. There's a being that has history and accomplishments.
Yeah. So what you're bringing up, what Bill's bringing up, very important fundamental question, what is the I? What is the self? Who are you? Deep teaching there. Let's acknowledge and set aside for the moment the question of a soul that's metaphysical or supernatural or transcendental, just honoring the possibilities there. In terms of pure psychology, what Bill is talking about is a very common experience of a kind of persistent, stable sense of I as a point of view about or perspective on one's own experience. And as the Buddha taught, and I think modern neuropsychology would also support, if you look closely at that sense of an I inside, it has the characteristics of being made up of many parts, arising dependently, and continuously changing. So when you look really closely in your own direct experience, there's that, in the technical term, an emptiness of that I. It exists. The sense of it persists, and our ideas about it persist. But what it claims to be as a unified, enduring, independent entity inside, if you look really closely, you can't see it. It isn't that. It's kind of vibrating, shifting, and quivering, and an opportunity for us. And it's also a major driver of craving. It's a major driver of suffering, taking things personally, insisting on your position, being righteous about things. The sense of that, or presumption, how dare you treat me that way, right? All that. Don't you know I'm important, right? All that stuff, right? What's useful is to, through mindfulness, observe the sense of I like any other content of awareness, just like a sensation or a sound or a memory. It's just content in consciousness. And then you sit back and you look at it and go, wow, shifting, changing. You start to unravel what feels very knotted and tight, me, 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 me. It's not philosophical. It's very direct. And it starts lightening up and loosening up. And it becomes more and more clear that there are tendencies, kind of habits over time that are associated with a particular body that has continuity of experience. There are certain tendencies that have a sense of I in them. And there's a loose usefulness of that. And when you look really closely at them, you start feeling freed up. You start getting off it faster. You know, you step out of your positionality faster. You respect the person you are, and you respect persons over there. You also let other people have more room to breathe. The person they are today is not the person they were yesterday. There's moral responsibility. We have to deal with the consequences of what we've done. But you give people room to breathe. Instead of, I think sometimes we take people like butterflies, we stick a tack through them and plug them to the styrofoam. Never going to let that one go. Nope. You, see the entity you, stable, unified, enduring thing, you did that. Bingo. And you are stuck there for life. Ah! Just imagine being on the receiving of that. And we do that to people. So the option is to look closely and loosen up about it. Yeah, and there's a lot of teaching about that. The metaphor the Buddha used for the self was a banana tree, which apparently as you unwrap it and unwrap it and unwrap it, there's nothing there when you're done unwrapping it.
So, Rick, what words would you use to talk about the concept, the role
of our free will on the way to no noise.
On the way to no noise?
No noise. No noise.
It's a deep, super question. And I so if you, so we're persons, we have bodies, we're existent, there's continuity, da-da. In the minds of persons, supported by various activations in the body, can be intentions, values, aims, right? And related to that, there's choosing, there's intending, there's, you know, getting ourselves to do things we don't really naturally want to do, but we get ourselves to do them anyway, of various kinds. That seems really clear. That free will question tends to get conflated with determinism or not determinism. I think it's really useful as a non-philosopher to tease those apart and to observe, wow, did the Buddha have intentions? Yeah, he set out. Wise intention is one of the eight elements of the Eightfold Path. He made choices routinely with people. So I think there's a place for intention and aspiration and willfulness, bringing a certain directedness to that. But that doesn't necessarily, notice what's implicit in the way that question is often asked, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a one who has will. So there's a conflation there as well. If just because there is willfulness arising, or intention arising, or valuing feeding children over not feeding children, or making yourself sit politely through the holiday meal, even though Uncle Bob's telling the same story for the third time in a row, right? Doesn't necessarily mean that there's some kind of unified entity inside as the screenwriter and director and main and leading person in your own movie. You see what I mean? So, and at the very end of it all, the way that it's described, and I along the way, I experienced this more myself. Oops, I'll finish in a moment. What happens, the way I would call it, I think will, in some ways, is to surrender to the best parts of you. So you will your own surrender to that which can then carry you along. And more you get a sense of people, including great teachers, who are simply carried along by currents of love and good intention moving through them. And there increasingly is a falling away of a kind of a personal will and more a kind of just responding to the needs of the moment. If I was really on my game tonight, I'd pull up some quotes I vaguely recall that say this really, really well. To finish, I want to go back to early childhood. I've often reflected lately, last few years, about the power of very early childhood experiences, the knowing we had as children, maybe in our teens, maybe as a young adult. There were things we knew. Very often, deep down, there's a knowing that it doesn't have to be this hard. We don't have to stress and fatitzle around so much, you know. We don't need to borrow so much trouble. People don't, often we see it out there, like they don't need to do that with each other. It's harder to see that I don't need to do it with other people either, but we have a knowing as a child. And I think so much of this is kind of, it's helpful to come home to what you know deep in your heart. Like, I don't need to hold it so tightly. It's not really that important. As my dad would have a gesture, don't fuss with that, Rick. You don't need to fuss with that. Just lay that down. Lay that burden down. You know, take the pot off the fire. And it's kind of a responding to that more and more. So that then becomes the motive engine of your life more and more. And if it's meaningful to people, that people can feel more and more lived by that ultimate silence whose name we are. Right? Okay. How about we sit for a minute, wrap it up. Henry. Be well. Take care. See you next week.
Something wasn't. Are we not meeting at all in 2 weeks?